Good afternoon, Your Honors. I am Nathan Berger. I represent the appellate. My number is 15545. When does a case start? When does an attorney actually start putting time into a case legitimately? When the client walks in the door and you talk to the client and a personal injury, the client says, well, some drunk hit me in the rear end and I'm seriously injured. Well, that sounds like it might raise a question, and at that point, you investigate. The attorney should investigate before he files the complaint. Significant investigation and significant work. In a personal injury, you get the medical records, the accident report, the toxicology reports. In any case, in this case, in the Jones case, a commercial theft and conversion case, when my client comes in, when does the case legitimately start incurring attorney's fees? When my client comes in and says, and creates a question in my mind, when the client comes in and says, I went to a tax auction, and I was the high bidder at this auction. And by the way, I was bidding against the owner of the property at this auction. The very owner who was trying to sell the property was bidding against me trying to purchase it. That raised some questions in my mind. At that point, the investigation needs to start. Who do I talk to? Who do I see? The auctioneer? The owner of the property? What does my client want? Is that legitimate attorney time to commence at that point? I think it is. And the more I investigate, the better it is for my client. I need to prepare a complaint. In order to do that, it takes a detailed investigation. The more detail, the better the complaint, the better my chances are of winning the case, which we did in this case. We had 100% success. It wasn't luck, it was work, it was investigation, it was time put in to the case. I don't know of any other way an attorney can win a case. There are a lot of ways to lose it, but the only way to win is put in the work and the effort. In this case,
are you saying, counsel, that you were not awarded any fees for any time investigating or preparing the complaint in the case?
Correct, Your Honor. The judge awarded 2 hours time pre-July, 2 hours time for drafting the amended complaint. And that's all the time that was awarded in this case.
And you had put in for time, you know, investigating or discussing with other counsel the merits of this case?
Yes, I sent a significantly detailed, very detailed timesheet in tenths of an hour, sometimes even in hundredths of an hour, detailing every minute that was put into the case, and submitted an affidavit.
Well, Mr. Berger, it's true that there were more claims in that complaint, and the case ultimately only went to trial, I believe, on civil theft and conversion, and that we're only discussing the fees that would be awardable for the civil theft claim. That's correct?
That's what the trial court ordered. However, I don't know that there's any dispute, and in fact, the trial court itself said it's indistinguishable, the civil theft and the conversion. They're so intermingled that you can't separate one from the other. And so to separate your investigation of conversion and the work done on conversion and theft is really impossible in this case. They're so closely related, the elements are almost identical on both claims. The Replevin claim, we withdrew before the trial, although that also, the trial court suggested, was interrelated. And according to the Helmsley case in the United States Supreme Court, if they are so intermingled, then there shouldn't be any deduction. And in this case, we went to a full four-day jury trial. And my client was awarded $15,000 for a full 4 day complete jury trial that we got a total success on the verdict. Just that information should be enough to raise a question. What's going on? How can a 4 day jury trial on a commercial civil theft claim be worth $15,000 to the winning party? That also the record, and I know there's a question with what happened to the record. Why don't we have the record? And I'm a little detailed. I like the record. I always like the full record. I try to get the full record in any case before this court. I don't want to go without a record. I don't know that I need the hearing, because actually I think the order itself is all this court needs to look at. But I wanted the hearing because that's where we testified, that's where various issues were brought up. But that wasn't available. For some unknown reason, there was a tape apparently of the hearing, but nothing was on it. Reminds me of the Nixon tapes.
Counsel, but to the extent that any portion of the record is missing here, don't we then assume that, or don't we weigh that in favor of affirming the trial court? We give the benefit of the doubt to the court and what it concluded, especially given that we have an abuse of discretion standard of review here.
Well, that's correct. However, the absence of a record is not the plaintiff's fault, not the plaintiff's doing. And there are some things that should make this court raise a question and eyebrows. In the first trial, there was another instance of a lack of a complete record, which we had to ask again to supplement the record in the appeal that we won. That the court, apparently there was a record from the clerk of the court that said the court had left, been turned off during a recess, came back, it hadn't been turned back on. That was in courtroom 601, not 505, as mentioned in the court's order. There's been issues with 505. That was courtroom 601, as shown on the register of actions. Then in courtroom 505, on this case, there again is no recording. My experience with recordings is sometimes maybe there's a word here or a phrase that's not entirely clear, but this is the first time I've ever had, well, record's gone, we don't have it. If there's a tape with missing records, to me that means somebody erased it. Otherwise there'd be no space, there'd be no time for recording. But there's a whole recording with no audio. How does that happen? That just raises a question. But in the...
What do you want us to do with that question, counsel? Isn't that a little bit of a distracting question?
Well, if the court feels the record is needed,
well,
that record is needed.
Well, did you reconstruct the record? Did you go back to the trial court and say, opposing counsel and I need to sit down and have you reconstruct the record?
Yes, we did. We tried to reconstruct it.
But you gave up on that. You at one point decided to go forward without that.
Well, after many months of attempting and going through it, trying to reconstruct the record, taking the record to a technical specialist to see if they could pull any audio off. And as I looked at it, I thought, well, maybe the order is sufficient. Maybe you don't need the hearing. But as I thought, well, this is a hearing we've already been through. What is going to be just if I already know what the court wrote and the court already wrote its order? What good is it going to do to have a whole new hearing with the same parties in the new court where everybody already knows what is claimed to be missing? Is that justice? Is that fair? Is that going to make an accurate, legitimate record? Or is everybody going to use hindsight and fix whatever may have been missed? It just didn't seem like it would be the right thing. The right thing, if there needs to be a new hearing, I think, is to send the parties to a new judge where there's no foreshadowing, no knowing what's going to occur.
But I would tend to think that before you would do that, you would have tried to exhaust your efforts to reconstruct the record, not at some point saying, okay, judge, we need to sit down and try to reconstruct it. And if the judge had said we can't, or if opposing counsel and the judge had said we can't, then maybe you'd have a good position. But I would tend to think that at some point where you say, well, we need a new hearing, well, first you've got to demonstrate an inability to reconstruct that old hearing, I would think.
Well, and
you may be running out of time, counsel, on the particular record part. I don't want to put you in a quagmire unless you want to be there.
Well, we did try. We made every effort to try and finally submitted an order to the court asking the court to certify the exhibits. I drafted the order, room for the court to mark it, and we didn't get it. That wasn't signed and delivered, a simple procedure. But as we go through the order itself, which I think is sufficient for the court to determine what process, did the court follow the required steps under Colorado law in determining attorney's fees? And in the order itself, on page 10 and moving over to 11, the trial court states, given that defendant's counsel billed for 58 hours of appellate work, a total of $17,400 using $300 an hour value, Mr. Berger's representation took more hours, but that much of his appellate product was cut and pasted from trial briefs. A reasonable lodestar figure is $27,000.
Counsel, since you raised the issue of attorney's fees on appeal, how can it be an abuse of the trial court's discretion when your client was awarded about twice the fees that your opponent incurred on appeal? So how is it that two times what your opponent incurred is an abuse of discretion? It seems to me within the bounds of a trial court's discretion.
Well, the amount generally is, but the procedure that the trial court follows is outside the standard and acceptable law that requires certain steps be taken. One is first you determine the lodestar, then you proceed to detract from that or go from that. But on the order, after he determined the lodestar, then he went to lodestar adjustments and made all these adjustments, and at the end came up with a lodestar figure. What the trial court did was say, here's what we're going to do, now let me go bring in whatever facts I need to do to reach this amount. That's not the way you do it. You take each fact, each hour, calculate it, put it down as the lodestar, and then go through step by step subtracting. It's not here's the amount I want to reach, it's what does the fact show I should reach, and that didn't happen here.
Well, Mr. Berger, in determining the lodestar amount, the court needs to calculate the amount of reasonable attorney fees, and I believe in the court's order, it was determining what it deemed reasonable. So is that what you are suggesting was an adjustment made to the lodestar before calculating the lodestar? I'm not quite sure I understand your argument.
Well, the order is difficult to understand. He basically says this is the amount we're going for, and then goes through the process of reaching that through various lodestar calculations, but the lodestar never changes. And so it's you can't tell how it was reached, how it was done, what's accurate. And I would point out one specific numerical error is when the trial court points out in its order that there's an amount of hours shown for the plaintiff's counsel and his paralegal, and that's affidavit and costs. We show 115.65 hours when I add it up, and the court determined there was 74, 75 hours in the affidavit. So the numbers didn't add up either.
Was this an issue that you raised in your opening brief?
No, not the specific number of hours wasn't brought up. It's just one I saw when I saw it after all the time put in, and I saw the date was a four-day jury trial where I spent 9 or 10 hours a day, and I saw the number. It just didn't make sense. Just an error, a clear error in the trial court's calculations. Thank you. I'd reserve the last 57 seconds.
All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Murray Wilkening, 15302 for the appellees, known as the Palitzi parties. First, I will address the lack of record. Second, the attorney fee awards. And then third, the costs and fees awardable for the hearing and on appeal. As Your Honor pointed out, this court ordered the parties to proceed pursuant to CAR 10C back in April of 2013. Parties went to the trial court. A statement of record was presented to the trial court from the appellant. A statement of record was presented by the appellee. Thereafter, nothing happened. Appellant sought a recording of the working with the recording. Nothing came of that over the course of about a year, 13 months. Eventually, on May 23rd of 2014, again, as Your Honor pointed out, appellant gave up and simply said they're not going to attempt to seek recreation of the record, simply get the trial court to confirm the exhibits from the hearing, and that was the end of it. Tennessee put certain requirements on the parties. In my brief, I quoted a couple of cases, Knoll versus Allstate Fire and Casualty. It's the appellant's job to ensure the reviewing court has an adequate record, doing everything possible to recreate the record. That didn't occur in this case. The result is this court must presume the evidence fully supports the findings of fact. With respect to the trial court's award of attorney fees, I'll address what was addressed on the first part of the argument, which was the award of time or fees and costs preceding the amended complaint. In this case, the original complaint contained two claims or two causes of action for conversion and replevin. And the case proceeded from that point, and it was set for trial. And I may have this wrong, but approximately 19 days before the trial, Ms. Jones moved to amend the complaint. And at that time, when she did eventually file the amended complaint, added the civil theft claim. At that time, she also added a breach of contract claim, a negligent misrepresentation claim, and a promissory estoppel claim. And from that point forward, those were the claims that were at issue. The trial date was reset. Those three claims were, though, kicked out on summary judgment by the trial court. And in its order, it's true, the trial court said that it's only going to award 2 hours for preparing the amended complaint, and that's related to the civil theft claim, saying that I'm not going to award hours before that time because you raised it for the first time in the amended complaint. Ms. Jones failed to explain to the court at the hearing how time was used prior to the amended complaint to develop that civil theft claim. And the trial court below was looking at that amended complaint and looking at the development of claims, this promissory estoppel claim, the negligent misrepresentation claim, and what Jones should have done at the trial on the hearing on attorney fees is to explain how much time was spent developing the promissory estoppel claim, how much time was spent developing the negligent misrepresentation claim, but she did not do that.
Counsel, how do you address your opponent's claim that the amount of the fees awarded for trial, the $15,000, I guess alone on its face, should raise concerns about the propriety of the trial court's order?
Well, the court, as I said, started with the amended complaint, and in its order, it does, starting from that point forward, go through the bills, and that's spelled out in the order. And the court looks at the three claims, conversion, civil theft, and the replevin claims, and at that point in the order, the court does say, I'm going to look at these as sort of a common factual basis. And from that point forward, does award basically two-thirds is the breakdown at each phase, before trial and during trial, the court says, and eventually, or essentially it says, absent some better, it says, in the absence of any more definitive segregation of work directed to the civil theft claim. So it looks at all of those hours and essentially goes two-thirds, one-third, again, not having received any evidence whatsoever as to a breakdown, a proper breakdown, or even an argument. And my brief points out the case of Pyon versus Nash Finch Company, which states, we note that it's not the court's burden to justify each dollar or hour deducted from the total submitted by counsel. It remains counsel's burden to move and to prove and establish the reasonableness of each dollar, each hour, above zero. And in that case, it was held the plaintiffs failed to present any proof as to the number of hours actually spent on the non-statutory claims. Given the lack of such proof, we will not disturb the trial court's decision. And essentially, that's what happened. And counsel did get every penny, two-thirds, and there was some argument how the trial court looked at some other factors and after the Lodestar analysis. That's not true. The court did look at other factors, but the numbers awarded are exactly the same, what it came up with for the trial court and the appellate court. With respect to the appellate fees, the trial court was very clear in its analysis there, and its primary problem was with some of the numbers charged. The 5 to 6 weeks of full time work to prepare the opening brief, half of it was cut and pasted, the comparison of the hours, to the point where even Ms. Jones' expert agreed this was an unreasonable fee. And the night before the hearing or the day of the hearing, you see in the record, counsel admitted approximately $40,000 should be deducted right off the top of the bill. What the trial court did was look at all the evidence, look at the expert's opinion. There's a detailed statement of each expert's opinion, and the court does come up with an analysis, a Lodestar analysis, and what it does, it looks at the Polizzi party's expert's opinion. And that opinion, that expert stated an opinion that they came up with a Lodestar number of $27,000 to $30,000. I'm sorry, it was 25 to 30. The court settled on 27,000. And what the trial court did was said this, everybody agrees, even Mr. Berger on the stand, everybody agreed that his fees were unreasonable and it was very difficult to use those bills to come up with a Lodestar number. In the end, the trial court relied on Polizzi's expert to come up with that number and relied on that, which, as your honors know, the weight accorded to expert testimony is within the sound discretion of the trier of fact. And case law is set forth in our brief. And the court stated its specific reasons, not only for relying on Polizzi's expert, but for discrediting the testimony of Jones' expert. And again, going back to the record too, if Jones spent $500 on 500 hours on writing up a brief, they should have gone through each and every element of their bills to prove why that is. They can't come here today and say we disagree with the court's number, not having tried to justify each hour. They left that to the court, the trial court to do, and the trial court did their best. The third part of the briefing is the expert fees. Case law, I believe, is very clear. The trial court has discretion as to what fees and costs are going to be awarded. That includes whether to award expert witness fees in the first instance. The order at page 10 talks about the credibility of Jones' expert witness, that their opinion was not credible or helpful. They suggested that Jones' fees were reasonable in some circumstances. The trial court obviously disagreed with that, and certain amounts could be paid even though would not be reasonable to charge their own client. All of those reasons were grounds to deny any sort of award for the expert fees. Finally, I've set forth some case law and argument as to why this court should deny an award of fees and costs for this case. The E-470 Public Highway versus Revenant case, essentially the civil theft statute is a one-way street, and that leaves no incentive for Ms. Jones to stop at any time from appealing and contesting issues in this case and believing all during the case they're going to get an award of attorney fees no matter what happens. At some point in time, that needs to end. And that's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Berger, you have a remaining 56 seconds.
Thank
you, Your Honors. Unreasonable, we deducted what we thought was unreasonable before we even started. That's not uncommon. That's professional courtesy and ethics to do that before you go in and start the hearing. The expert fees, because the court doesn't think an expert is credible, doesn't mean you don't award fees. That's not an issue. The case law is clear that you need to make findings. The court made no findings why there were no expert fees. That's required. Experts need to be paid when they come in and testify on these cases. The cut and paste, just by looking at the briefs, you can see there is some. You copy a case, you cut and paste. That's a general to say you cut and paste a brief, you cut and paste your opening statement, you cut and paste your facts where you cite the record. How do you do that out of the trial court? You got to go through the record, pick it out, put it in. That can't be cut and pasted. That's the key. I think the key is the facts when you put it in. That takes more time than just about anything. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.